If there's something I need, I don't already have. I know I'll get it from a good friend. If there's something I need, I don't already have. I know I'll get it from a good friend.
Hi, everybody. It's Jamie Lee Curtis, and you're listening to the Good Friend Podcast, presented to you by iHeartRadio. It's a podcast about friendship. We talk about everything. We cry, we laugh, we think about what it really means to be a good friend. And I have conversations with some of my best friends, some people I've never met, and sort of everything in between. So I hope by the end of it that you have a really good sense of what friendship means to me and the people that I consider friends. And I hope you can take those same ideas into your own friendship groups. And I hope you enjoy it. Good morning or good day or what? I don't even know what time it is.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
Yes. Morning for you, afternoon for us.
Yes, how lucky for me and my listener. I do believe we have one. So I like to refer to them. I'm not grandiose. I don't pretend I have a billion. I'm content with my one listener. They're loyal and interested and they lean in and they will be so excited that my guests today are Mark Nepo and Susan McHenry, a partnership as well as two separate artists, two people that I have separate relationships with, and people who I consider good friends, even though we've really only met in person a couple times. Yeah. So welcome to the Good Friend Podcast,
thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you. And I agree. It's that, you know, that sometimes we know each other deeply in a second. And that lasts forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We know each other in a second. And it does take a second for many, many people in many ways. And then there are people who are in each other's orbits and it takes them forever to actually come together.
Yeah. Well, I know I felt that with you immediately or instantly. And that doesn't often happen.
No, I'm always struck by it. It is a feeling that happens where I am struck by a connection that is as instantaneous as it has been with both of you. Mm-hmm. For my uninitiated listener, if you know me at all, I don't like the word follow or listen because I'm not a prophet. I'm not a, you know, I'm a dope fiend and a liar and, you know, many things I have done wrong in my life. So you do not, the whole idea that we in social media, we have this word that we follow or that we listen to, like, ugh, I'm not a doctor. I pretend to be one once in a while for money, but I am a human. And my human part is more human because of a book that I have talked about in many circles, in many ways, which is called The Book of Awakening. And it is written by Mark Nepo. And it was our first point of contact, which I just thought was a good way to start talking, which was, how did we find each other?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I feel I so agree with you. Even, you know, I do a lot of teaching and all kinds of things, but I really don't feel like, I feel like we're just keeping company or opening up a space. You know, I was struck that the word interview, it literally comes from the French and it really means the view between. So it's not about one person, oh, tell me. It's about we gather and together we open up a depth together. And I think that's what happens with friends too, is we go to a different place because of our love of each other.
Oh, Mark Nepo.
Just, where did he come up with these things?
You know what? He's a poet, and that's the beauty of it. You paint with words. That's, you know, poetry. It's spectacular. I just want to ask you about the Book of Awakening for a second, because we've sure. actually never discussed it, and my listener would be very interested. How long, like, did you know you were going to make a Book of Awakening, or did you back into it, or did you forward into it?
Well, kind of both, in that, you know, on the other side of my cancer journey, and you know, Susan is an adult child of an alcoholic, and my dearest friend is in recovery for alcoholism almost 38 years. And so I've had people in recovery around me forever. And so, you know, Susan was always showing me initially like Melody Beatty's books, mm-hmm. And I would see people everywhere with these day books, mm-hmm. and they were like a modern form to me. Like they were really used, you know, they were mm-hmm. in back pockets, in cars, in bathrooms. And so on the other side of my cancer journey, I started wanting to, I thought, and Susan helped me think about maybe if I could fill that form with small doses of what matter, maybe it could be something that would be helpful. And then I began, it took 3 years, you know, you think a day book, oh, that's just a little thing a day. Oh my God, mm-hmm. you know, there's 365 of them. And so I began, I had big pots. I had pots of feelings, stories, themes. I had a big pot of quotes so that I could honor other teachers. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking about what kind of meditation. So I wound up, it took like 3 years to create all the drafts. And then Susan got me, you ever see these huge office planners that are erasable that you pin on the wall?
Baby, they are my jam. They are my jam.
It was epic to figure out a strategy for where would each of these entries go, or how would you order them, or, you know,
yeah,
how would you proceed with forming the book and putting it together? So the dry erase board was.
So Susan got me that, and I tacked it up on a wall, and then very intuitively, I would just take a look at them and go, well, if this were to be a journey, because you can certainly, as you know, go in anywhere, but if it were to be a journey, what would I start putting across this garden and plant here and plant there? And then that took several months to do. And then it actually took another 8 or 9 months to actually conceive of the meditations and literally try them out. There were a bunch that didn't make it because they just were, you know, when I went to try them, they were like, this is never going to work. I don't want to do this. No one's going to want to do this. And then finally, we had a whole draft.
But the interesting thing is that you, the book was accepted for publication with, was it just five entries?
Yeah.
With five entries sent in.
Yeah. And that tells me how hungry that publisher knew people were for this meal that they couldn't get anywhere but with you creating it for them. But really what's interesting to me, and of course I didn't know we would go here. I really didn't. I don't have a plan. I have no notes. You know, my dog is at my feet. Your dog is at your feet.
She just tore up her monkey toy. So
of course, because that's
right. I think that's a good sign.
It's all, but what's moving to me, what has moved me already today, is the partnership and the friendship between the two of you.
Aww.
That you, Mark, are gracious in your acknowledgement of Susan's part in the creation of this book that has changed lives. That it isn't just your book, even though Mark Nepo's name is on the front. That what I'm seeing, hearing, and feeling, which I must have intuited, is that is friendship. Mm-hmm. Whether or not there are romantic parts of the friendship and body parts to the friendship and liquids exchanged. Really, what we're talking about is connection and friendship, and the way, the grace that you bring Susan into this part of the conversation is as important as the offerings themselves. That as important as they are, what's more important is your acknowledgement that you didn't do it alone, that you wouldn't have gotten that big ass dry erase board on your own.
No way. And
your ability to expand yourself enough, your ego is strong enough, to be able to say, and by the way, listener, Susan is an accomplished artist in her own world of pottery and painting, that she is a visual artist you can touch. She's a tactile artist. You know, her work you touch and you use it. It is hand built so that you feel her hands in the piece. It is part of her gift. But it just so interesting to me. This is a show about friendship. And I knew we would talk as friends, but I didn't know that what was really going to present itself is already, there is no greater friendship than if you're married or if you're in a partnership, a love partnership with someone, that is the complete, that is the relationship. It is friendship.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's at the core.
For us,
absolutely. I feel lucky for that. I think I felt that with Mark right away, like a certain comfort, you know, that I hadn't felt with other people, other men. So a comfortable feeling. Like, I just remember this little thing, like the first time we went to the grocery store together, like, I just remember this feeling of standing in line at the register and being like, oh, I just feel like, this doesn't feel like the first time I'm doing this. You know how like everything is, you know, the first time you do everything, it feels like, strange, it can feel strange or a little uncomfortable, and it just felt so like natural and comfortable. And I think like that is really for me what friendship is. It's like not having to pretend to be something else with whoever you're with, or not having to hide any parts of yourself or feel like you have to present yourself in a certain way to be received or accepted. Or And I think it's rare. I still feel like at this point in my life, it's rare. I can count the people in my life who I feel that level of comfort with. I can count on one hand, or that I have felt throughout my life. I think it's a rare thing.
But isn't that sad and beautiful at the same time? Yeah. I mean, I'm weeping. I'm weeping right now because what you just said is everything that we want. Yeah. I want you to see me and want to know me.
Yeah.
And I don't have to pretend to be something I am not in order to get your attention and gaze.
Right.
And the idea that we spend, when you say it's so rare, it makes me sad that it's so rare.
Yeah, I know.
That we walk around in these masks and costumes of our lives when all we want is to be seen.
Yeah. To be seen and heard and held and honored.
Oh, now I'm going to cry.
but it's such a, it's, as you said, it's so pure. It's just, it's what we want. And yet we do so much to avoid it. to hide who we are because we think we won't get, you know, it's the Steinbeck. I'll throw Steinbeck up all the time, but there's a quote of one child denied the love he craves, kicks the cat and hides his secret guilt. That there we crave love and attention. And by the way, I'm not just talking about actors.
Right. We're all
humans.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, and I feel, you know, that Susan has always been it's so interesting because we all have our gifts. And Susan has always, I felt, been a teacher in her, how big her heart is. And while I can, you know, I mean, I'm certainly loving and kind, but when I have the ability to paint it, to portray it, but she has all, and it's, you know, that, you know, there's an age difference between us, there's 18 years between us, but she's an old soul and she's always been this amazing teacher of the heart. And I never, you know, there's a moment that represents that when, I'm going to talk about the bird.
Oh,
you know, I, as you know, Jamie, I go teach and I used to travel. We'll see if we do it again, but well, I would always travel and teach and then I'd go home and I came home one time and maybe 10 years ago and I found Susan in the garage over a shoebox. And I looked in there and a bird had injured itself. Turned out it had a broken back. We didn't know, but a little bird. So it's on a towel. And Susan was feeding it water drops from her finger.
Of course she was.
Yeah. And you know, it's just tumbling to me like how she is such a teacher of holding nothing back, of giving her all. And I keep, you know, and I think the other thing about being lifelong dear friends at that level, whether you're partners or not, is honoring each other. I believe that when you love someone, you want them to grow, not stay the same. And so like we've been together over 25 years more. I should know how many years, but it's,
I forgot.
Yeah. But, but you know, I know her well enough where I can finish her sentences, but I don't. But not just for the obvious reasons that she'd be upset if I did that, but because loving her means, and her me means that I want to ask her, I know that's how you've always felt, but who are you today? What do you think today? What do you feel today? Has it changed? What have you seen? And in that way, we're constantly growing.
Well, I think isn't that what you hope friends can do? But besides just intimate partners and you know, love relationships, just friendship in general, it's very brave to say, who are you today? What are you thinking today? How do you feel about blank today? And because you're risking someone to say, yeah, I'm not as into it. And that is terrifying. And what happens is we build up that calcification around it. We go, I'm not going to go into how are you feeling about it today or me today or our relationship today or our interactions today. I'm just not going to. And the longer you go, the harder that calcification grows around it. It's harder to imagine cracking through. And there's a E.L. Doctorow quote about when things go unexamined for a long enough time, certain things happen. They become mythological. They become very, very powerful and they create conformity and they intimidate. So the conformity is what happens in relationships, in friendships. You start to just kind of conform to it. It isn't living and breathing as much anymore. You're not leaning in, as you just so eloquently said, Mark, of, you know, where are you today? Because it's too scary that they may have changed. And so I have tried as an adult to failed, by the way, many times, listener. So don't think that this is like me, like I've got this like all going on. But I'm in the process of trying to break from that calcification, that mythologic nature of relationships, so that we can meet in the here and now today.
Yeah. I think for me, like one of the gifts of my relationship with Mark is that we've always been really good at like just putting it all out there, like, you know, conflict, bring it on, you know, we do that well together. I feel like we argue well, you know, we argue, yeah. we're, you know, we have heated arguments, just fights sometimes. But we always come through that in a better place. And I've never been afraid to go there with Mark, even though I've been terrified to go there in lots of other relationships, you know, either with family members or friend, mostly women friends. So I've been where, you know, when you were just talking about that, I feel like that's been riskier for me to do in those other relationships. Mm-hmm. But I've learned through Mark, like it can be okay. And if it actually, if, you know, if I raise some kind of conflict with a friend and it ends up not being okay, that's a lot of good information I'm getting about that person, that relationship. What did I bring to that dynamic to help create that? And now I've realized, you know, I don't really have any interest in giving my life energy to a relationship that can't withstand some kind of, you know, dealing with a conflict or dealing with my hurt feelings, or, you know, it's like, why am I putting my energy into that if it can't be received there?
So old ideas, new ideas.
Yeah.
I kind of divide the world into it. And it just allows me to kind of do what you said, Mark, which was to be able to be me today and say, who am I today? I often will say, well, that's an old idea of mine, and it's no longer an idea that I support. And it's kind of amazing to say it out loud. And you go, oh, wow, look at me changing my mind.
Well, I think another aspect of friendship is, and all of these things for me come down to the commitment to try to practice just to be real as it happens, as it changes. And that's in honoring limitations too, you know, like our love, and I feel this with our other friends too, you know, my commitment. You know, I'd say, you know, I know the Dalai Lama said that loving kindness is his religion. I think friendship is mine. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm blessed to have good friends, and I'm a devoted friend, but I've learned, and Susan has helped teach me this in our relationship, that while my heart is committed to be everything and do everything, I can't. And so if I am going to be a good friend, I can be a better friend if I honor my limitations. And you know, so that and I think this happened years and years ago, you may not remember, but, you know, a time when I was needing to go to Susan emotionally for something. And you said, I want to be there for you, but I can't right now. I don't have it to listen. And so if you really need someone right now, you should call one of your other friends, and, you know, the next day or so I'll be able. And, you know, at first I was like, well, yeah, but I need it now. And then I said, no, this breaks this romantic notion in our society that we're going to be all things at all times to each other. And actually, it's when we pretend that we can be there and we can't, that we do good poorly. And it's actually worse. you know? So that's led to us like, not you know, when each of us wants to be there for each other and we can't be, well, we're never really happy about it, but we honor it. And it's actually better to be able to say, okay, I'll call my friend George or Robert now, rather than insist when the other can't. You know, if you physically think about, oh, like if you're carrying something, you say, oh, do you have it? Do you have that end of that 200-pound thing? Well, I've got to say, if it's real, yes. If not, I can damage both of us if I say that I can when I can't.
If there's something I need, I don't already have, I know I'll get it from a good friend.
We'll be right back with more Good Friend after this quick break, so stick around. I think that may be the most profound thing I've heard in 32 interviews, which is the ability to acknowledge that you can't be all things as a friend to everyone. You can't. And that accepting your own limitations is the greatest act of friendship in a way. Being, you know, many of us, and I'm sure me, you know, we kind of get into that false ego pride of like, I'm solid and therefore bring it, which is just actually a lack of boundaries. it's some desperate need on my part to be everything for everyone, which is impossible. And as you said, which you used incredible words for, that in a way, if you say you can do something and you can't, it's actually harming them. Like it's kind of under the guise of goodness, but it's not, because you're not really able to. And I know my listener has done this. And I dare say if that listener tells another listener, they would say, oh yeah, me too. Yeah. Which is that immediate thing of like, we don't have the courage to say, you know what, I cannot handle this right now.
Yeah.
What we say is like, okay, I'm really stressed out, but okay, what is it? And then we're not really listening with an open heart. We're listening with a kind of controlled experience in a way that doesn't really serve the person. And I think you're better served if you can actually say the thing you said, which is, again, the gift in your partnership and your friendship that came from you that Mark just articulated. It's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary concept.
It reminds me of when you were speaking about that and when Jamie was just speaking, it reminded me of that statement you made once when you were teaching somewhere where you said, do you want to be good or do you want to be true? And often, how often those things are at odds with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been,
that's been a great teacher for me. I come back to that at, you know, many, many times. I don't always remember to, but
well, of course
and, not. I, and I fall down, but you know, yeah, but that's been a great teacher for me.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me about it. But again, I think that's been a big lesson for me that I know that, if I try to be good, I may or may not be true. If I try to be authentic and true, I will almost always be good, the same way that a flame will always give off heat. And so I think our challenge is to be, and that's led to these daily practices. Once we can accept our limitations and accept our commitment, whether it's us or in other friendships, and our limitations, then it becomes being real in the moment. So if we're talking and you're sharing something so, so tender and I lapse, you know, I got distracted. I can say, but you know, at first I would think, oh no, I just, you know, you just opened your heart and oh, I don't want to say that, you know, I got distracted and thought of ice cream, you know, like what the but no, I need to say, wait a minute. I know this is important and I got distracted. Can we back up and keep and go? That's a microcosm of accepting our limitations and being real.
I'm going to ask both of you the same question, which again, not written, no paper. But I'm just curious because I don't really know your backgrounds. I don't do a big deep Oprah dive here. I try to, let it flow. But I am curious as to sort of in your earlier life. I don't know where your earlier life was, Susan. In your earlier life, friendship. How did friendship? Were you part of big groups, little groups? How did you sort of connect with people? Was it through the arts? Was it like what was your relationship to friendship?
Well, I grew up in upstate New York, and I don't know. I think like when I think of my earliest friends, just being a small child, were mostly, you know, neighborhood kids. So these were the days when we would all just leave the house, you know, during summer vacation and play, be out all day playing with our friends just in the streets and in the neighborhood. It wasn't probably until I started playing clarinet in fourth grade that I maybe became part of a larger, you know, where it felt there was a community of people connected around a particular thing, a particular, you know, common interest. I do remember really wanting to be, so like in the Girl Scouts, the first phase of Girl Scouts is brownie, right? Mm-hmm. And I had some friends who were brownies and I really wanted to be a brownie, but so I wanted to be a part of that group, you know? But there were not enough moms who were volunteering to be like whatever the moms needed to do to be the leaders. And so I couldn't do it. And how sort of devastated I was by that. I think, to be honest, my relationship, you know, I certainly had friends growing up and all throughout school, but I always felt I always felt sort of outside the popular group. You know, like I tended to be friends with people who are more on the fringes, you know, which was just fine with me, actually. And then probably like, you know, it was probably when I got my first job when I was 16 that I developed some really close relationships with the people I worked with. It was in a grocery store in the town I grew up in. And they were some of the best closest friends I had. They weren't really people. It wasn't so much people I went to school with. It was the people at this grocery store. And, you know, they all knew about, I had a lot of trauma growing up and, you know, from growing up with alcoholism and violence in my family. And I didn't talk to many people about that until probably I met those friends through that job. And some of them knew, you know, most of them who I was close with knew what was going on. And I think that changed how I felt about friendship at that point. I felt like these were people I could trust and share more personally with. And yeah, I look back on those years as like, those were some, you know, those were good people who I met at a pivotal point, you know, my teenage years that helped me maybe start to individuate too and see a world outside my family.
Isn't it interesting?
Some
interest, you know, in school, music, that, you know, how many musicians have, you know, I interviewed my husband and his band from childhood, David Nickturn and Chris, and they bonded over bluegrass. You know, that was their connect. They knew each other growing up. Their families both knew each other, like same street and all that.
Yeah.
But they weren't connected the way the parents are like, oh, he loves him. Oh, that's his wonderful friend. But they weren't. But what connected them was this love of this, at the time, arcane music, which was bluegrass.
Yeah.
And then that cemented it. So it's so interesting to me the way you talked about it, where you find commonality with people in music and school, and that then you're part of a group and that feels good. And it like builds up that, oh, this is what this all looks like.
Right.
But then being in this job more now as in starting to individuate from your family and everything. And then you end up bonding with people because you start to expose yourself and tell the truth.
Yeah.
They listen, they respect it, they hold it.
Yeah.
It's a safe space. And it's just such a perfect description of how friendships are built and nurtured and developed. As a young
person. And I think that I hadn't, until you asked, I hadn't really thought about that, about them representing, that sort of a shift happening in me at that moment and maybe how I was learning to view what real friendship looks like and how that enabled me to see that. So.
And then the kind of person that you are in your partnership with Mark and like, am I seeing that beautiful interchange between the two of you is just to see, it just gives me a little sketch of how did you end up sitting where you are. And Mark, what about you in your early life?
Yeah. And let me just also, as you were mentioning about safety, that the word friendship actually comes, the root of the word means place of high safety. Place of high safety. So for me, I grew up I didn't have addiction in my family, but I had a lot of dysfunction and a lot of difficulty. That both my parents are gone now, about 6 or 7 years. But in high school, I was not a loner, but I didn't really have any friends that I would call a real friendship till I got to college. I did feel like I grew up on Long Island outside of New York City, and I experienced a lot of anti-Semitism as a kid. And so I was on the basketball team, and I was kind of visible to lots of people, but I felt very alone in all that. Mm. I felt like very alone in a crowd. And really, when I think back, I never thought of it this way till you asked this, but I think the first presence of a true friend was my grandmother, my grandma Minnie in Brooklyn, because she was the first one to really see my soul. I mean, I didn't know those terms back then as a little kid, but she treated me with, I guess you'd say, respect that I felt in her presence, unlike I felt anywhere else in my little life. And I knew that was something that was important that I wanted elsewhere. And when I got to college, I started to have some true friends. And I think I didn't know this then, but certainly with all these years in between, I think because I didn't feel a sense of not physical safety, but emotional safety in my home. And I didn't feel like I could show all parts of myself, that even at an unconscious level, I was always ready to make my friends my family outside of my home because I wasn't able to get that in my home. And so friends were always a sacred space for me. And I've had friends, I've always been amazed at this and wondered at this, because there are friends that I have where there is nothing they could do that would break our bond, no matter how they would screw up or be hurtful. It was just forever and endless. And, we deal with it or whatever. And there have been other friendships along the way where there have been trespasses and it's been cut like that. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered, like, why the one and why the other? And so I think that, I have a friend, Robert, who is my oldest friend over 40 years. He's the one who's in recovery. And we met in graduate school in Albany. Both are poets. And we immediately, it's like our souls knew each other and we were just meeting this time for the first time. And I have here in Kalamazoo over the last 15 years, I have a men's group that I'm a part of, seven of us. And boy, we've become like brothers. Mm-hmm. Just like, it's just been so important to me and so amazing to, it's a space, because I think all of us, the men that I'm talking about, you know, I did finally, by the time my father passed, we had a good closeness. I never got there with my mother, but even so, my father, well, there are lots of things I admired about him, and I realized that he taught me more since he's died. I never had a model of the kind of man I wanted to be. I kind of had to find that myself. And I think that the other men that I am close to also have that kind of want to say, yeah, I can admire this and that, but this isn't it. That's not what I'm interested in trying to be. I don't see a lot there that makes sense.
We'll be right back with more Good Friend after this quick break. Boy, I'm telling you. We could do this for like a year. I'm not sure iHeart would be so happy with a year's podcast, but hey, you know, Book of Awakening, sort of a daily, just a conversation that lasts 365 days. iHeart, maybe this is me pitching it. Wouldn't that be interesting? Just like an ongoing conversation for 365 days of people who didn't really know each other and get to know each other through this medium.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I know. Hey, but two things popped into my mind. One, my mother had a friend whose name is Gwen Davis. She is still alive today. And she was a writer in the 70s, and she wrote really wonderful books. She wrote some very sort of, you know, sexual books with, you know, sort of Jacqueline Suzanne kind of level of intrigue and sex and, you know, conflict and all the rest of it. But she also was very funny, and she wrote a book called How to Live in Suburbia When Your Heart is in the Himalayas. And, you know, she was the reason that I knew about Jack Kornfield. She was the first person to teach me how to meditate, even though it didn't work because I was 18. But she saw me. And like your grandma, this woman saw me. And in the midst of all of the people that I knew at this point, now I was an actor and I was on my own, very young, and with all my family and my beginning of my career and all the rest of it, this is the only person in my entire life who ever looked at me and said, I see you and I think you're amazing. And I think you have a mind, you're bright, you're creative, you're interesting, and I see it. And by the way, she is a pain in the tuchus. As a person, she is a pain in the tuchus. For my listener, that's bottom in Yiddish. You know, she is a challenging person. She is the smartest girl in the room and has a quick wit and bite, but she's also a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And she'd be the first to say it, but people are kind of put off by her, but I have been devoted to her because she was the only person in my early life who said, I see you. Mm. And when I didn't see me at all, when I was just sort of bouncing around, that popped in my mind when you were talking about your grandma. And then, you know, I'm in recovery 22 years now. And I will tell you, that your idea of a men's group, you know, the beautiful part of recovery from drug addiction and alcoholism is that you call it recovery, and there are recovery meetings and recovery groups, and you bond with people, and you create these very tight safe spaces where you can all share what you're feeling. If I was smart, I would just open one up for friends and call it girl group and offer the same thing. It doesn't have, but we could all read the Book of Awakening as our sort of text and then talk about our feelings vis-a-vis the whatever the offering of the day is from the Book of Awakening. But that safe space to model behavior, to hold mirrors up for each other. Because I didn't have it either, Mark Nepo. I didn't have it. I didn't see it from my mother and how to be with female friends. I certainly didn't see it from my father and how to be male friends. I didn't have that modeling. And I think what you said was profound, that you have that.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's so interesting because, you know, of all the teaching I do and, you know, experience facilitating. So when we first gathered, you know, there was a lot, I had given a lot of thought. Does this group need structure? Do we need process? Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, as soon as we got together, because we were all there simply to be who we are and bear witness to each other's lives, it all happened so organic. We didn't need anything. And ever since, all we do is, it is very basically organically like being in rooms, but everyone takes their turn. We meet once a month. Well, now during COVID, we're on Zoom twice a month, but usually we meet once a month at different people's homes, and everybody takes as long as they want or need to talk about where they are in life from in this moment to in the big picture. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if people want to be mirrored or want anything else, we ask each other, I'm having trouble seeing this. What do you see? And we just go around. And then once a year, we go on retreat together for 3 days. Mm-hmm. We just, you know, get a bed and breakfast and are just there, all of us. But I'll tell you another profound moment in that is that I think speaks to friendship. It was Don with his back that time. And our elder in the group, Don, is 83. And we've been meeting for like 15 years. And the first few years, it was wonderful. But we didn't have a whole lot of contact outside of the meetings. And Don, he had his back went out and he was, you know, out for like a week, you know, and we all checked in, we called. But when we all got back together, he, with real vulnerability, took a risk. And he said, you know, I appreciate you guys calling, but how come none of you came over? Mm. And we all went, oh my God, we didn't. Sorry. I don't know why. What happened? And from that point forward, we haven't been a group of friends checking in on each other's lives. We've been in each other's lives. And, you know, he took the risk to with tremble in his throat, to be real honest about that. And it changed everything.
Isn't that spectacular? Isn't that just spectacular?
Yeah.
By the way, I just want to speak to Zoom for a minute and these technologic portals through which we try to connect and express ourselves. This podcast was born out of the pandemic and my not being able to be in as close proximity to my friends. And I heard Emily King's song, Good Friend, and I thought, oh, I'm going to do a podcast and talk to people that I love about how being friends impacts their life, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I've been in recovery, as I said, 22 years, and I've been doing recovery meetings on the computer for the last year and a half. And by the way, I had never, ever, ever done FaceTime. I always thought FaceTime people were losers. I would be like, people were like, hey, you want to FaceTime? I'm like, no, I don't want to look at myself. No, cameras, no. And what was so interesting is and our daughter, Annie, was the first one. Was like, Mom, you just set up a Zoom account. I was like, She goes, just do it. And I remember doing it and clicking that button. All of a sudden, she was there. Yeah. And there was that moment of like, oh my God, hi, baby, hi. And I realized that it was an old idea in my brain, right, that technological FaceTiming and Zooming meant something fake and it was weird. I'm telling you, my recovery groups have deepened to a level that I never thought would happen. And the truth of the matter is, I don't want to go back to the in-person meetings as much as I want to stay in this group, because the depth of the sharing, the depth of and the ease of it. The ease of it. If the founders of all of these recovery groups had this opportunity, they would have used it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Old ideas, right, new ideas.
Right.
And this is a new idea that is working. And my listener is nodding as they're folding their laundry right now as they're listening, because it's working for them.
Right.
That they get the kind of depth of contact, substance, yes, that this is offering, to hear the two of you in conversation about feelings and friendship and love and families. It's extraordinary. And this is just a wonderful new idea. And I am, you know, beyond thrilled that we're here together. Now, before I let you go, I will remind you that even though we don't know when these are airing and therefore or dropping, I guess, as the kids say, I don't know, do podcasts drop or do they air? I don't know. It's not in the air, right? It's I don't know what it does. However this gets sent into the world. In the Book of Awakening, which has been a daily read for me for a long, long time now, it is as important to me as a connecting tool to my own self, as well as to others. It has completely enlightened me as to who I really am because of the way I respond to what Mark has put out there. Today's was all about feelings. And I actually, a friend of mine this morning wrote me and said, feelings suck. Thanks, Mark Nepo. By the way, you've actually been reduced to one name. You are not Mark Nepo. You are Nepo. So the text was, you know, feelings suck. Thanks, Nepo. But it was all about feelings. And, you know, obviously what we've been talking about here together are feelings. But you mentioned, Mark, that there was a poem that you were going to share with my listener and with me and with Susan McHenry, your love and your friend. And me, Jamie, your friend, your good friend, about friendship. And I thought I'd let you finish us out here on the podcast.
Sure. Well, thank you. And thank you for I'm so always touched by how the Book of Awakening has touched you. So this is a poem called If You Want a True Friend. If you want a true friend, just open your hands and say, I don't know. Say it softly and wait. so your other can see that you mean it. Give them a chance to drop what they think is secret. Let them come up with a cup of what matters from the spring they show no one. Let them sigh and admit that they don't know either. Then you can begin with nothing in the way. Go on, admit to the throb you carry in your heart, and let the journey begin.
My guests today on the Good Friend podcast were and are and will continue to be Mark Nepo and Susan McHenry. To my listener out there, stay safe. God bless you. And thank you both so much.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
Oh, thank you.
And for your friendship.
And thank you for your friendship, your good friendship.
Good Friend is produced by Dylan Fagan and is a production of iHeartRadio. Our theme song, Good Friend, is written, produced, and performed by Emily King.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.